From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In a speech next week, President Obama will lay out his plan to create new jobs and try to breathe new life into the U.S. economy. The issue of unemployment has become highly politicized, with the president caught between Republicans who say that the government is the problem and Democrats who say the government should do more. Today on Radio Times, we get two perspectives on creating jobs in today's economic and political environment. Bill Dunkelberg is chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Business. Michael Youssim directs the Center for Leadership and Change Management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Stocks are plunging on Wall Street this morning. The Dow is down more than 200 points right now after the government said job growth in August was flat. The government said employers didn't add any jobs and the unemployment rate remained at 9.1%. Mesirow Financial Chief Economist Diane Swonk says it's not a good report.
This is extremely bad. Zero is not significantly different from negative.
NPR's Sonari Glinton says it's the weakest report in almost a year.
It's the first time since 1945 that the U.S. government is reporting that net job growth is zero. The jobless numbers were affected in part by a strike. 45,000 Verizon workers walked the picket lines, which lowered the job totals. The number of long-term unemployed, that's people who have been out of work for more than 27 weeks, remained unchanged at 6 million. The long-term unemployed accounted for nearly 40% of the jobless numbers. Meanwhile, President Obama is set to address the nation next week on his plans to bring those numbers down. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
It's packing a lot of rain and heading for the Gulf Coast. A big storm system could reach the south central Louisiana coast tomorrow as a tropical storm. For now, though, it's a tropical depression. Still, Eric Blake at the National Hurricane Center in Miami says it has grown slightly.
Still located about 240 miles southwest of the mouth of the Mississippi River. Maximum sustained winds are 35 miles per hour with higher gusts. Tropical storm warning remains in effect from Pascagoula, Mississippi, westward to Sabine Pass, Texas.
The storm could drench the region with up to 20 inches of rain. Louisiana's governor has declared a state of emergency because of the threat of flash flooding. Nearly a week after Hurricane Irene blew through, businesses across southeastern North Carolina are preparing for the Labor Day weekend. Michelle Bliss of member station WHQR reports that after closing their doors during the storm, hotels and restaurants are waiting to see how Irene's timing will affect the tourist season finale.
Craig Galbraith, a hospitality management professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, says that while many businesses are reeling from the loss of a weekend's income, some beach communities may actually benefit.
Folks that were planning on going to the Cape Hatteras area, the Outer Banks, or maybe up into the Washington, D.C. area or Virginia, you know, certainly those areas were hit much harder, and so it's likely that a number of those potential customers or tourists will look to southeastern North Carolina.
Hurricanes tend to, he says, have a larger effect on long-distance travelers who haven't grown up around hurricanes. They're more likely to shorten beach vacations or avoid them altogether. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Bliss in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Again, stocks are plunging on Wall Street this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 209 points at 11,285. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting The Debt, the new thriller starring Helen Mirren, now playing in theaters everywhere.
10:04 on Radio Times, I'm Joanne Allen, WHYY News. A high-ranking official in the Philadelphia Archdiocese lied to a man who said he had been raped by a priest as a boy. The Inquirer reports Monsignor William Lynn told the accuser that the priest denied the allegations when in fact he had admitted to the assaults. Court papers show Monsignor Lynn told a grand jury he lied to the boy because he believed the priest's admission was a confidential matter. Lynn's grand jury testimony is part of an abuse investigation targeting him, three priests, and a teacher. The Monsignor says he also decided against pursuing sex abuse complaints if parents reported them instead of the child. Most Pennsylvanians support natural gas drilling, according to a new poll. Nearly 70% of respondents want lawmakers to pass a severance tax. More from State Impact Pennsylvania's Scott Detrow.
The Franklin and Marshall College survey shows nearly 70% of Pennsylvanians view the natural gas industry favorably. About 40% think its benefits outweigh environmental risks. That's a bit more than the 35% who put concerns about water and air pollution above drilling's economic boost. Respondents are on board with drilling, but they also want to see it taxed. Pollster Terry Madonna explains.
Pennsylvanians say, yep, let's tax. Let's divide the tax between local communities and the state. Yes, the industry is doing the right thing. They're doing a good job. But oh, by the way, you better be careful about the environment.
A strong consensus also emerges on the issue of whether or not to lease out additional state forest land for natural gas drilling. 72% of respondents are against the idea. More than 700,000 acres of state forest land has already been leased out. Annual royalties from drilling there will likely surpass $100 million within the next few years. Scott Detrow, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Wilmington Council has approved a plan to realign the city's eight districts. Each district is expected to have about 8,800 people. Under the plan, the entire Wilmington Riverfront community will fall under one council member. Phillies in Florida starting a weekend series tonight. Partly sunny, highs 80, 75 at the shore. 71 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia. This is WHYY 1006.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The official employment numbers for August are in, and they're not good. The economy added no new jobs last month, the weakest performance in almost a year. The economy needs to create several hundred thousand jobs a month to reduce the rate of unemployment, which has been stuck at more than 9%. That number does not include the people who are underemployed or have given up looking for work altogether. President Obama is going to lay out his jobs plan on Thursday evening at 7 before a joint session of Congress. The U.S. needs to add some 20 million new jobs to regain full employment. Meanwhile, the size of the labor force has been shrinking. What can be done to reverse that trend? And we have two guests who have joined us today on Radio Times. And joining us from Florida is Bill Dunkelberg, professor of economics at Temple University. He has served as the chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Business since 1971. He's also chair of a small bank in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, Liberty Bell Bank. And Bill Dunkelberg, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, always a pleasure.
Also with us is Michael Useem, and he's William and Jacqueline Egan Professor of Management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Center for Leadership and Change Management. He's also the author of several books on leadership, including The Leader's Checklist and The Leader's Moment. And Michael Useem, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Marty, good to be here.
Well, let's start with those numbers. And Michael, if I can start with you, the jobs numbers essentially stayed the same. No new jobs were created in August. What does that tell you?
It tells you our economy, certainly in terms of rehiring, is at a stall. And just to put a couple numbers in front of us to wrestle with, if we've got about 14 million people unemployed, another 8.5 million working part-time who really want to work full-time, and then what economists tend to call discouraged workers, people who have looked for a job, haven't found one, have stopped looking. I've got maybe another 3 million people in that category, give or take. So put those numbers together. We've got about 25 million people out of a workforce of about 140 million who want a job. To personalize that, my guess is every listener pressed to name one or two people they know, maybe the daughter or son of family friends, maybe somebody in their own family, everybody knows one or two people who are looking for a job, don't have a job. And maybe just one more swipe at this. The economy really took a hit, of course, in 08, 09 with the financial crisis. Employers stopped, no surprise, lots of layoffs at some of the big companies that were most affected. But to get back to where we were pre-08, pre-09 in terms of employment, we need 12 million new jobs. Wow. That reflects the loss of jobs and the fact that we have a lot of new people in the workforce of an age where they can work that want a job and don't have a job. So outer outline, that's what we're looking at here in terms of our big problem.
And I do want to talk about what can be done about that. But Bill, let me get you in on the conversation and give you a chance to respond to those August numbers. What do they say to you?
Well, they certainly tell us we don't have any growth in the economy, because if firms had more customers, they'd certainly hire workers to take care of them. The zero number, of course, is just an anomaly. It'll be revised. It probably will be revised downward. But it's interesting that we hit zero. There are 45,000 Verizon workers who could go have a job if they just wanted to go off strike. So you could say it was 45,000, not zero. But that's a terrible number, 45,000. We need about 125,000 a month net new jobs for population growth, as Michael kind of suggested. And then, of course, if you wanted to reemploy just the 8 million people that got fired, forget about all the working part-time or having a job that you didn't want, et cetera. If you just wanted to employ the 8 million people, get them back to work, say in 3 years, you divide 8 million by 36 months, and you get about 220,000 a month. So you need over 300,000 net new jobs every month for 3 years to kind of get us back to where we were at the peak in 07. So that gives you a rough idea of where we need to be versus what we've seen, which is, double-digit numbers, 45,000 jobs or zero or 25,000. We're just so far off of what we need that it's going to be a long haul before we can get the employment levels back to where they were.
Bill, do you think it's a demand problem, that there isn't enough consumer demand for services and products?
No, basically that's it. A firm cannot hire a worker that isn't going to bring in enough extra value to the firm to pay for them. Otherwise, the company goes bankrupt. So what you need, of course, is sales. And in the NFIB survey that we just finished in August, one out of four still said weak sales, poor sales is their top business problem. That's down from around 33% last year. But those numbers are, the highest numbers we've seen in the 37 years of our survey history, including, of course, the 1980-82 period, which was what used to be called the worst recession since the Depression. Now we got a new one. But, we clearly have poor sales is really a driver here. If we had customers, then these small firms would hire somebody to take care of them.
And, Michael, it seems like a circular problem, which is that businesses don't hire because they don't know if they have the customers. And if they don't hire, then we don't create jobs, and then we don't create demand.
Yeah, consistent with what Bill just said there, surveys of larger companies basically say the very same thing, that it is a matter of weak demand. Issues of taxation, issues of regulation factor in, but it is weak demand. And that's the circularity we have. Weak demand, fewer people employed, less money for consumers to put back into the economy. And to break out of that, call it a vicious cycle here, intervention on behalf of the rest of us does need to come from Congress, does need to come from the White House, and equally, I think it needs to come from the private sector.
Well, in fact, you wrote a very interesting piece calling out big business, if you will, saying that it's time to make people a priority and not just earnings. And you were talking about this focus on shareholder return, the idea that a big business is in business to make money for the shareholders. And you're saying it's time to think about everybody else?
Yeah, here's a kind of an underlying factor that I think explains why we got into this fix, is that over the last decade, institutional investors, the big holders of a lot of money, the pension funds, the investment companies like Fidelity, the endowments of places like my own institution, putting pressure on companies to – these are typically investments that go into larger companies that are publicly traded – putting pressure on companies to deliver high and consistent quarter-on-quarter returns have pushed companies to – tighten up on everything, including their employment, number one. And number two, to really focus in a very narrow sense on what the company is doing. And I think historically what that's created is managers at the top and boards at the top of the companies that are almost by definition, given how the owners look at them, how the big institutional investors treat them, focused on their own very narrow self-interest. My view is we've just got to get beyond that, and I think it's time for companies to take steps, top executives to reach out, directors of companies to take a stand, that we've got to get on beyond this partisan gridlock in Washington, number one, And number two, equally importantly, for companies themselves to take a step a little bit into the unknown here of just simply deciding to do more hiring for the moment. We can talk about the mechanics of that, but I think companies, this is the moment for them to step forward and to begin to hire, even if the demand is weak.
And Bill, I do want to get to you, but Michael, just a follow-up to that. What has been the response from your article? And you are telling, I mean, you could perhaps argue that this is in a company's long-term best interest, because if we don't have people buying things in this country, then we really don't have much of an economy.
Yeah, I think that's the unfortunate squeeze that has come from the way our equity investing system has worked, with the big institutional holders. They hold these days two shares out of three of big companies like Procter & Gamble or American Airlines. The big institutional holders, no surprise, most of us are part of that story there because we have money saved up in pension funds and other kinds of investments in these companies. They look logically for consistent quarter-on-quarter growth. The effect of that is to focus directors and top executives to look at the quarter, to look at the year, rarely to look at a whole lot of years out. The result has been, call it myopia, we're focused on the here and now, we're not focused on the long term. And I think there are ways in which top executives and directors and really institutional owners as well can move beyond that to focus on the long term. It's in their self-interest to do so. We just got to make it happen.
Well, Bill, let me turn to you. And as someone who is chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Business, and we know that small business, a powerful engine for job creation in this country, what do small business people want?
Yeah, I think, you know, I like Michael's point. I would like to kind of put it in perspective, though. The big companies that he's talking about, stock-traded companies, those are interesting, and of course we watch them every day and see how they're doing. But most of the companies that employ people in the U.S. are, you know, are not publicly owned. They're small businesses. 90% of the 6 million employer firms out there have under 20 employees, and so they don't have boards of directors, or all they have is an owner out there worrying about, you know, what we're going to do next. And so they really don't they don't have foreign subsidiaries. They don't have foreign earnings. They don't have any of this other kind of stuff. So last week, you know, the initial claims for unemployment were 409,000. So in simple terms, 409,000 people lost their job. And apparently we, you know, hired enough. So that'd be like 1.6 million for 4 weeks. And we apparently hired about 1.6 million. So we had zero net job growth, you know, last month. But GE employs, a big company, only employs 150,000 people in the United States. So if they doubled their employment, you know, it would be nice. It'd be 150,000 more jobs. But it's, you know, it's not where the action really is. America really works at small businesses. And that's where we have to try to figure out, you know, how do we get the small businesses back to hiring? That's really the key.
Well,
and,
Bill,
of course, we just pointed out that weak sales is their top issue, but 25% said weak sales, my top business problem. 35% said taxes, needless regulations, and red tape are my top problem. So we do need to deal with that. And Michael is right. The uncertainty issue is a real big one. The Consumer Confidence Index for the Michigan survey is the lowest it's been since 1980. That's terrible. Mm-hmm. People have no confidence in the future. They have no confidence that Washington can put us on a path that will be different than what we see in Athens or London. And we know those governments are misbehaving. We know we're misbehaving, and we don't see them doing anything about it. That's scary. And so 9 out of 10 people who want to work still have a job, and they could spend more money, but if they're cautious, which they are, and the spending doesn't go up, then that's really a drag. If we could just be optimistic about where we're going, we'd spend a little more money, and that would really help a lot.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to get back to our conversation. Both of our guests have put out some very interesting things for our discussion today on Radio Times. In anticipation of Labor Day on Monday, we are talking about how to create jobs in this uncertain political and economic environment. The voice you just heard is Bill Dunkelberg. He's a professor of economics at Temple University. He also is the chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Business. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is is Michael Yuseem. He's a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, directs the Center for Leadership and Change Management. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. What do you think can create jobs in this country? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at ChristianaCare.org/heartleaders.
On September 11th, an NPR News special, coverage of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for memorial services from Ground Zero, the Pentagon, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We'll also report on how the day is being remembered around the country. That's special coverage from NPR News, the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Sunday the 11th, starting at 8 a.m. on WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne, host of The Sound of Young America. Every week, I invite people who I think are awesome over to my house for a conversation about what makes them awesome. Comedians, authors, rappers, rock and roll guys. Don't let the name fool you. It's not a kids' show, but it is a show for people who appreciate fun. I hope you'll tune in this week to The Sound of Young America from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang, getting two perspectives on creating jobs in today's economic and political environment from Bill Dunkelberg and from Michael Yuseem. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Bill, you mentioned regulations and seeing that as an impediment to job creation. Interestingly, the Obama administration has come out with something like 500 ways or 500 changes in regulations, and hoping that that will help small business create more jobs. Do you see that as a sign of progress?
Well, I think if we actually make some serious changes in the regs, that'd be good. One of the problems we have with Congress over all the years is they love to put new rules and laws into place, but they never kind of go back and review them and see if they're still relevant or if they're working incorrectly, so that they never kind of clean up the mess. You don't get voted in for cleaning things up. You get voted in for doing new things. And so there's a tendency for Congress to neglect these things. So, you know, it'll be good if we get that. The problem is that, you know, that the under Dodd-Frank, there has to be 400 to 500 new regulations written. That's a requirement. No telling how many regs we're going to write under the health care bill. It'll take a long time to find out. So maybe we're getting rid of some, but there seem to be coming on at an even faster pace. And you know, I know, for example, in our small bank, we spend most of our time, we have monthly board meetings, which is a lot, and we spend most of our time on regulatory compliance, not on how do we grow the business, how do we, you know, get into the community and get new loans generated and help small business. We spend it on regulatory compliance, and if you don't have every I dotted and T crossed when the regulators come in, you're in trouble. And so we spend an enormous amount of our resources, which is very limited, on just complying with all this stuff. And it's very, very costly in terms of resource use.
Michael, anything you want to add to that? And I do have a question for you about corporate leadership. And anything in response to what Bill just
said? Well, just to pick up on what Bill has said, I think we need, it's pretty obvious here, changes just in a host of policies that ultimately Washington is ready to put through or maybe dispose of in pulling back certain kinds of regulations. For example, right now it's difficult for companies to bring cash back in from sales abroad because of tax issues. You'll see estimates that many large U.S. companies that do operate abroad, about half of the operations of the Standard & Poor's 500, America's 500 biggest companies, about half their operations these days are abroad. And they've got about $1 trillion just sitting in bank accounts offshore. Difficult to bring that back. So some kind of rethinking of taxation what amounts to double taxation a good idea. We've got free trade agreements pending. I think it's for South Korea, Panama, and Chile. That's something for Congress and the White House to work through. Energy efficiency. Buildings, if they are, let's make it 20% more preserving of their energy, one calculation back of the envelope is that that would yield $40 billion more of just plain cash for companies to put into new product development or certainly hiring. So consistent with Bill, we need a lot of action out of Washington.
Well, you have mentioned corporate leadership, and I wonder, Michael, though, whether there is enough will in the sort of upper structure of our economy to do the kinds of things that you're talking about, which is think about your community, think about the country, think about hiring people, and put those shareholders slightly on the back burner. But they've done so well for themselves by not doing that.
Yeah, I think the phrase, think about the community, think about the country, besides the company, is the way to sum it up. And somehow we got to break out of this vicious cycle or this deadlock. We say, Congress, would they please step forward and think more aggressively about putting in place great policies? Would the White House become more aggressive in terms of solving the problem? But I think business has an independent and very important role to play here in also breaking out of that gridlock. Just to start the discussion there, Howard Schultz, the chief executive of Starbucks, however you like your coffee at Starbucks, I think you'll like what he's been saying the last couple of weeks, which is that companies like Starbucks, they really need, and other companies need to step forward, push Congress to act. That's part one of his advocacy. But he also has said companies like Starbucks, we just need to begin to hire. Mm. We need to do it. We need to be a kind of a front runner. It may be short-term loss. It probably will be, but a long-term gain.
Bill, do you think that would help small business, that attitude change?
Well, sure. Well, it'd certainly help. I mean, if anybody starts hiring people, obviously those are new incomes that will be created, and people spend most of their income. You know, in this country, we spend 95 cents out of every dollar we earn. So, you know, every new job would provide an income stream. Well, that means, you know, customers are showing up at small businesses. And again, that's the reason that you hire somebody, is to take care of a customer. And it really takes – really, it's going to have to be consumer-driven. You know, we've got all these deals in where you get 100% depreciation if you buy some equipment or a truck, and you get, you know, and of course interest rates are really cheap, et cetera. But, you know, a really cheap truck that you can't use is not a cheap truck. And so we find that the capital spending on the part of small business is about as low as we've seen, in our 35-plus years of surveying, because there's no reason to do this stuff, and that's the difficulty. So you don't hire because you don't have customers. You don't expand your business because you don't have customers. You don't buy new equipment and so on because you don't have customers. So the key really is, you know, try to get the consumer back. And again, that is has become increasingly an issue of confidence, as our consumer surveys show. And as Michael pointed out, you know, a lot of that is really generated by the uncertainty coming out of Washington. Again, you know, most people who want a job have a job, and they could spend more money if they were more confident about the future. So we could get more spending from those of us who are still working, and we know there's a recession statistically, but we're not part of that, and we could spend more money. But if you think that we're coming apart, you know, if the wheels are coming off the wagon here, everybody's cautious, and we have to get rid of that caution. If people are more confident, they will spend. That'll be good, and that'll get the job creation machine started.
Well, let me turn back to you, Michael, and I want to focus on what you think then government can do, and we know a little bit about what President Obama is going to talk about next week. One is the extension of the payroll tax cuts, some kind of tax incentive for employers who hire, and then spending on public works, and by that I mean, I guess it's infrastructure. We're talking about jobs and bridges, and we can see what Irene did to the East Coast. Is that, do you think, an effective investment? If government focuses on infrastructure, will that help not just people using the roads, but also help Bill's people who are hiring?
Let me cite an expert on this topic, the Laura Tyson, she's on the faculty at the University of California, but she had been the head of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. And in her view, and I'm drawn to this, and I don't study this as a topic, so I'm really deferring here to other experts, to say the least, is that something like a national infrastructure bank where we can put a lot of cash.
Public and private cash.
Public and private, and solve some of the problems that are becoming all too evident in this country, especially if you contrast our infrastructure now in the U.S. with the infrastructure of many, many other countries. Name it, China, Slovenia. Americans traveling abroad, if they have the cash these days, many don't. But if you do go abroad, it is stunning how infrastructure elsewhere has pushed ahead while we have not. So in and of itself, infrastructure, a topic to be worked on. But in terms of there aren't a whole lot of levers that government does have to create jobs. Infrastructure investment is one of the stronger ones.
Bill, let me just quote something from Matthew Slaughter. He was on George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, and he said this, America's decaying infrastructure costs the typical American worker hundreds of hours in lost productivity. It also costs companies time and efficiency in moving their products around, and also out of the country. Do you see that as a good investment by government?
Well, you know, I think infrastructure is a role that government has to play for a whole lot of reasons. Not necessarily the federal government, but state and local governments. And you know, I'm sure there are major kinds of things we can improve. You know, I travel abroad a fair amount, though, and I have to tell you that, you know, except for the kind of the high profile kinds of things I see in the rest of the world, you know, the infrastructure is no better any place else than it is in the U.S. Just for ordinary folk, you know, out in the country, in the state. I mean, we've got an amazing infrastructure system. Doesn't mean it can't be improved. It certainly needs to be improved. But the problem is that doesn't generate a whole lot of jobs per se. I mean, we tried that in the Stimulus One package, and of course, not much happened there. And the other problem we have is that we get a bunch of government, federal government sponsored stuff. They virtually always require that that the work be done by unionized companies, which of course eliminates basically all the small business contractors and so on because they're not unionized, and so they're not allowed to participate in those kinds of things anyway. So that's not going to really solve our problem. Again, most of the people in America are employed out with those small firms. It's in the non-professional services sector and. You know, all that kind of stuff, that where the spending isn't back, and I don't think that having an infrastructure program will work very well. Infrastructure bank, I don't know what, you know, that just means we're going to borrow more money, I guess, to get this done, and so we could do that without trying to create a bank, unless we really are going to allow private investors to somehow put their savings into this bank and get a good return on their money, which is pretty hard to do at any bank these days because interest rates are so low.
And that's Bill Dunkelberg. He's a professor of economics at Temple University. He's also a chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Business. Michael, you seem with us as well. Professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, directs the Center for Leadership and Change Management. And both of them joining us today on Radio Times to talk about how to create jobs in today's economic and political environment. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We got Andrew from Pineville to join us on Radio Times. Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, first I'd like to say that President Obama should fire the guy from Princeton he just hired and hire the guy from Temple. But at any rate,
thank you.
In 2008, I started a project at our business, small business. It's a restaurant. And borrowed $2 million to do a major expansion. We've, in the last year and a half, we've hired 35 more employees. Our business is flourishing. People are coming out to eat in droves. It's good value, and that's besides the point. But if someone wanted to do that now, it would be virtually impossible. Interest rates mean nothing. I don't care if they're 5% or 12%. The bottom line is that no one can get enough equity because real estate values are so far down. They can't get any money from the bank. The bank's regulators are being absolutely ridiculous. As stupid as they were the last time to get us into this mess, that's how stupid they are this time. trying to get us out. I think small business is definitely the key. And the other key and the biggest key and what's pulled us out of the worst deficit after World War II and the worst deficit in 1980 was housing. We have the population. We have the demand. More babies are being born than ever before in history. And these poor kids have to put 20% down. They're strapped with college debt. And I really think it's a banking thing, and the banks would rather sit on the sidelines and collect high interest rates on credit cards and not be at any risk for their stockholders.
Well, Andrew,
but I really appreciate both sides. This Bill and Mike are just terrific.
Well, I appreciate your phone call to Radio Times. And, Andrew, I think I know what restaurant you're talking about. let me, though, go back to you, Michael, because he talks about banks sitting on the sidelines. They're making lots of money, as Andrew says, because they've got many consumers with credit card debt rather than lending money out. Is he on to something, do you think?
Yeah, he is. And I think we all know that banking has consolidated a lot in recent years, partly because of the crisis and partly just because that's what happens in banking over time. And if you think about Bank of America and Citi and Morgan Stanley and all the other major banks, they are sitting on a lot of cash. They do, as Andrew has indicated, they are creating now difficulties for people who are trying to build business or to buy a home. And I think the challenge here is to break this deadlock. So if you talk to senior bankers, they say, look, this is what we got to do. This Dodd-Frank bill that Bill referred to along the way has made it tougher on banks to operate, maybe for good reason, maybe not. We can debate that. But taking that all into account, senior bankers will say, look, we've got to do what we got to do because our shareholders want us to do it this way. Regulations push us, and it is the hard reality. The economy is flat. To break the deadlock, I think the chief executive of Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase and Citi and the other major banks across the country need to get together. And in some collective sense, we've got to worry about antitrust here. Decide to break out of this along with Congress and the White House breaking out of this. And for what it's worth, there's a proposal out there. I like it, coming from somebody who's thought about this in the private sector. We need some way for large companies, let's pick on the banks here for a moment, for them collectively to commit to hiring and to breaking some of the deadlock elements that are particularly vexing in banking. For none of them to do it individually, but for all of them to do it if they can collectively reach an agreement. Joe Nocera of the New York Times has called this a contingent commitment facility. I think that's one way to get going.
Well, that's quite a mouthful. I wonder, Bill, if you want to weigh in on the mortgage issue. And interestingly, Ben Bernanke said that a good proactive housing policy would help put people back to work. Do you see a connection between our problems of hiring and our mortgage foreclosure crisis?
Sure, and there are a lot of twists on this. Let's start first with just the hiring side. Demographically, I think Michael mentioned that. You know, we should be building 1.5 million houses, starting 1.5 million houses every year. You know, apartments, condos, and single family houses. We're only doing about 500,000 or 600,000 right now. So we're 1 million housing starts short of where we would normally be, and that's a small business enterprise. That's small businesses build all these houses in all these little towns across America. So 1 million housing starts. So I don't know how many new jobs go with that, but let's say 5 new jobs go with each housing start, you know, for 9 months till the house is built. I mean, that's 5 million jobs right there that normally we would have because housing usually leads us out of a recession because interest rates are low, et cetera, but can't this time because we, of course, built millions of extra houses from 2003 to 2007, and they're still there. So we have far more houses of various kinds in America now than we have people to live in them. And, of course, not everybody can have a second home, so people aren't buying them up. And it's going to take a long time, really, to get that solved. It's really difficult. So even if people aren't buying a house, they have to live in a house. That is somebody, they're going to live somewhere. Somebody owns that house, rents it to them if it's not an individual owner. So the real problem is just there in, like, 2 million houses of various kinds, rental apartments, whatever, that we don't have people yet to live in, and so it'll take time for that to work out. On the banking side,
well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, Bill. Only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Bill Dunkelberg and Michael Useem, and we are talking about how to create jobs. And we're going to get some more callers in on the conversation as well at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111, 215-762-1111.
Face.
Barbra Streisand's new album is devoted to songs with lyrics by Alan and Marilyn Bergman. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the Bergmans. Their songs include That Face, The Way We Were, Nice and Easy, How Do You Keep the Music Playing, and What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A sight that could replay.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And in anticipation of Labor Day and the president's speech next week, we are talking about how to create jobs. And our guest, Bill Dunkelberg, joining us by telephone, chief economist for the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Employers, particularly those in small businesses, are often hampered by regulations that make adding new employees very difficult. Our other guest, Wharton professor Michael Useem, has written that the responsibility lies with corporate leaders who need to, quote, reset the business mindset, making people a priority, not just earnings. We are shoehorning their ideas into our conversation, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get back to our callers, but Bill, I wanted to just give you a moment or two to finish your thought about, banking.
Thanks. I appreciate that. There was a comment about the big banks. The big banks are making a lot of money. They're not making it doing banking, which is collecting savings and making loans. They're doing it on trading, all kinds of things that we're not sure banks ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. So those top 20 banks are making a lot of money, and they're very big. But there are about 7,000 independent banking institutions out there, a lot fewer than there used to be. It used to be 10 or 11,000, but there are 7,000 out there. They're small. They do all the lending for small businesses. And I speak to these organizations often. I did Consumer Bankers in Orlando about a month ago. I'm doing California Bankers in a couple of weeks. I did New Jersey Bankers a few weeks ago, and the story is always the same. We have money to lend. We do not see loan demand. People are not asking for the loans. Now, in our survey, the NFIB survey of its 350,000 member firms, you know, we're seeing record high numbers. 67% of the owners said, we're not even interested in a loan. 28% said, I got all the credit I wanted, and only about 8% said, I didn't get all the credit that I wanted, which is a little higher than at the best we've ever seen. 5% is the best we've ever seen. Back in 2000, which was a pretty good year when we employed 64.5% of the adult population compared to only 58% today. But so the loan demand is not there. Only 4% of the owners say financing is a top business problem. They just don't have a reason to borrow, and they're not coming in to the bank and asking us for loans. So we do have excess reserves to lend out, and we're trying to find places to invest it. And that's really kind of the interesting issue. Again, you know, they're not going to borrow the money to hire somebody or to buy new equipment or expand unless they think that the investment they're making in people or in the expansion will pay off so they can pay the loan back.
Let me get Giba from Sharon Hill to join our conversation. Go ahead. You're at Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine.
I was just wanting your guests to come in on my statement here. What I've usually found out recently is that most companies are laying off workers and spreading, you know, the job around to the fewer workers that, you know, that are left. And, I mean, the job is getting done. Companies are making profits. They don't even see the need to hire more people. Like where I work currently, we just lost 5 workers. But the job was spread around to other workers, and the job is getting done. So, you know, there's not much incentive for companies to actually, you know, hire people at this time, especially with all the economic turmoil going on.
Sure. That's a very interesting point, Akiba. Let me toss that to you, Michael Youssim. Do you want to weigh in on that? Which is
sure.
The companies have figured out that they can get more productivity out of the workers that remain.
Yeah, and all the productivity numbers are up, and that's partly the story we have right now. And companies are looking at the fact they can get the work done now with fewer people. But that's been the American way that I think we have to somehow transcend, which is as hard times have come, the American way has been to lay off workers as opposed to job sharing, income sharing among them. Germany in particular has a bit of a different tradition. We're not Germany, but it's worth looking abroad to see if we got some ideas we can bring back here, which is that during hard times, what about it's hard for people, myself included, if we had to do this, what about keeping the employees on but cutting back to 35 from 40 hours per week? So there are other ways to skin this cat. And again, I think that's what companies ought to be thinking about to get around the problems that they can't solve, the taxes, regulation, and so on. But this is a problem that company leaders can solve and should solve.
Isn't that what Germany did?
Exactly.
Largely speaking, rather than lay people off and then try to figure out how to hire them back, they kept people but just reduced their hours.
And companies here and there, this is a hard path to stay on, have decided, say, back in 08, 09, despite the hardship, for so many companies in our economy with that financial crisis, that they were not going to lay off. They were simply going to some degree, furlough, to some degree, cut back on certainly no increase in wages, but also just cut back on the work week. When better times came back, they had the loyalty of the workers that were there. And I think that's how we also have to do a kind of mental reset here, is to look at workers, employees, mm-hmm. us all, as assets and not costs to be cut.
Bill, just a quick response, if you don't mind, because I do want to get back to our callers, but I'm curious, what do you hope President Obama says next Thursday night?
Well,
what do you hope? What do you want him to say?
Yeah, well, it would be nice for him to say that, you know, he's going to figure out how to get a path into the future that will make us all comfortable, that we'll know, you know, we'll be able to really agree with whatever comes up, that this is a solution to the craziness that we're involved in. That would be nice, but he can say that, and he may want that, but, of course, we're not going to believe it until we see something. That is, we have to see an agreement that will give us the confidence to go ahead and spend more money and invest and know that the economy will get better. So we have to see a path we believe in, and right now, you know, we don't see one, and the consumers tell you that in their surveys and in our survey of small business owners, same deal. There's no confidence that we're going to get these problems solved and that a disaster, you know, could come along. That's the concern.
Well, and Michael, picking up on this confidence word, and because you direct the Center for Leadership and Change Management, does the president have a confidence problem?
He definitely has a confidence problem, and it's one of the great challenges of anybody's leadership to keep the faith on the part of the people that they are purporting to lead. I think President Obama has the capacity to restore that confidence, and ultimately what it's going to come down to is tangible results. Bill said this as well, and that is we need, in his speech, specific job-creating measures that we can all agree upon. To add to that, we hope that, and this is what political leadership is all about, is that people don't completely depend upon Washington to solve the problem. And this comes back to Howard Schultz's great idea, the CEO of Starbucks, which is that individual companies, this is more, I think, going to be the terrain of larger companies because they have the wherewithal to do it, to, in this period, to step forward, to begin to look for job-preserving measures on their own part, and even job-creating measures at a time when maybe the demand doesn't warrant it, but bringing more people onto payroll, they're not an employment agency, but bringing more people on the payroll in ways that make sense, I think would make sense for the country. Just to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, let's take the Standard & Poor's or Fortune 500, the biggest companies, the names we all know. If each one of those simply added 1,000 jobs to the payroll, Walmart right now employs 2.5 million. 1,000 jobs is a drop in the bucket. Facebook employs almost nobody. So
about 2,000 people
worldwide. They're not going to do it. But Hewlett-Packard, 400,000. I think these companies have it in them to hire. Let's make it 1,000 just to round out the figure. If it costs $75,000, $100,000 by the time you put in fringe benefits and retirement, we're talking $100 million that would otherwise not be spent on, in this case, 500,000 new jobs. The chief executive of a large Fortune 500 company these days averages about $10 million in compensation. And so how about a few chief executives stepping forward, knocking down their 10 to make it $9 million, bringing 1,000 new people into the firm? I think that would be a kind of a pace-setting measure that smaller companies, I think, could look to. Look, if the big guys are doing this, surely we smaller companies can hire a couple.
Let me see what Rich from Bucks County has to say. And Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I have comments in two directions. I'm a small manufacturer in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Had to cut back from 50 to 35 employees during the recession. And interestingly, we first went to reduced hours with some job sharing. And then I made the decision that we had to take care of the people that we're going to need to grow back with. And so cut way back and brought my core group back to 40 hours because we didn't want to lose them in the long term.
Right.
But the demand is there. We've been forced to, when I say forced, we've had to increase our hiring again in order to keep up with demand. I don't understand what goes on the higher levels, but I don't think CEOs, to comment on the last thing I heard, I don't think CEOs are going to sit back and make a decision to hire unless they need to. They're not going to do this out of any altruistic bent.
Well, Rich,
my comments...
hold on to that thought, and let me just ask you a quick question. I want to get Bill Dunkelberg back into the conversation. What does your company do, Rich? Just curious.
We manufacture industrial rubber products. Our customers are throughout the U.S. and Canada, and we are our customers' customers are selling to process industries throughout the country in every sector.
Well, and Bill,
and my industry as a whole is up 25%.
Well, that's interesting. Bill, you want to weigh in on this? I mean, we talk about the economy as if it's all one and the same, and clearly there's some bright spots and some dark spots.
Right. You know, as we've kind of talked about earlier, normally you have housing surging and consumer spending surging to lead us out of recessions. This time that hasn't happened. What you've seen as the bright spots is manufacturing, inventory rebuilding and all this, and agriculture. Those have done very well. Exporting has, of course, been very, very strong, and that's been very helpful. So it's a very, very different shape in the economy. And so so the caller is quite right. You know, even amongst NFIB's 350,000 members, the bright spots are in manufacturing. They did a great job of hiring last month in our survey. They increased employment quite dramatically per firm. And, of course, agriculture is looking good as well. So even amongst the small firms, those sectors are doing well. Then you go to the non-professional services side and so on, and restaurants, and you see a lot of weakness on that side. So it's never even, and it's certainly different this time. There's no question about it.
Rich, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Peter from New Britain has to say. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that one of the problems is free trade is not really free. There's a lot of so-called liberal arguments, but frankly, we're dealing with countries that won't allow U.S. companies to set up operations without 50% or 51% ownership. So it isn't really free. And it's only free for corporations at that. If I want to import drugs from Canada as an individual, I can't. But Merck is quite welcome to import drugs from India or China. And as we saw with Baxter Healthcare, without much for quality control. And so it's a... it's an unfair free trade.
Well, Peter,
that's my comment.
Well, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. And let me toss that over to you, Michael. And I should say to our listeners that you just got back from a visit to China. How do you factor in free trade when we're talking about creating jobs?
Well, the world's got a long ways to go on this, to say the least. And the caller is absolutely right that there are so many ironies in how free trade is actually implemented. Sometimes it's free, in a sense, free for us to invest, but with all kinds of restrictions once we get there. Having said that, I think historically, as we look back, the world has been moving towards international commerce unrelentingly for the last 25 years. And on balance, I think it is going to create more demand in this country if our companies, let's make it Boeing, can sell aircraft in China. And so opening up China with its entry into the World Trade Organization was a critical step. Unfortunately, a lot of jobs also fled to China in terms of some basic forms of manufacturing. But on balance, I think the research evidence is supportive of this assertion. Free trade actually benefits everybody, but it really has to be free on both sides.
You were in China recently, a place that you've gone several times, and of course they have a very different kind of government than we have here in this country. But we were talking before the show began, and you just described this powerful economic engine. Every time you go there, the country looks so different, at least in the urban areas.
Yeah, just to comment on that very briefly, if you look at growth in China or growth in India, each over a billion people within their boundaries, they're each chugging along at 8 or 9% per year GDP growth. They've been doing that for many years. And both countries are with many problems, especially infrastructure in India, political freedoms in China. Both countries are moving along extremely well and creating lots of jobs. I don't think we can't emulate what both are doing, but I think we can learn from each. On this issue in front of us this morning as follows. In India, having just completed a project on Indian business leadership, those who run Indian companies of middle to large size, think Infosys, if you know these names, or Tata or Reliance, do look at their employees quite differently. They look to keep them on through hard times. They champion employees in their policies. And I think that's to be admired. Leaders of Chinese business, there are lots of huge Chinese companies now. Lenovo, a maker of personal computers, one example that sells a lot now in the U.S. The leaders of Chinese companies, it's partly the way that Chinese economy works, look at what they're doing as partly a private service, private rules, but also they look at their companies as contributing to national growth, national prosperity. And for my two cents on this, I think if certainly the leaders of larger business, Bill can talk about certainly the smaller and medium business sector, could step forward and think about this collectively, I think we're going to have a part of a good solution.
Well, Bill, you're going to have to pick up on that on another show because we are out of time. Bill Duckenberg, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Michael Youssef, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about those program or this program, I should say. And we do thank you for those phone calls. We'll be right back. And do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We're replaying some of the interviews that we have done over the last year or so with writers. And coming up next, my conversation with Diane Ackerman. She wrote a book called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and The Language of Healing. That's next on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM Atlantic City, WNJZ-FM Cape May Courthouse, WNJM-FM Manahawkin, WNJB-FM Bridgeton, and WNJS-FM Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. Diane Ackerman was on a book tour for An Alchemy of the Mind when her husband, Paul West, was hospitalized for an infection. She was at his bedside when he suffered a massive stroke that left him speechless. This was particularly painful because West was a writer too, and words had been so important to their relationship. Diane Ackerman has written a book about how West was able to learn to speak and write again with therapy and through flirty wordplay. Her book is called 100 Names for Love. We're rebroadcasting that interview today, part of our End of the Summer series with Writers on Writing. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Stocks down sharply after the government turned in the weakest jobs report in a year. The Labor Department says employers stopped adding jobs in August and the unemployment rate held steady at 9.1%. Analyst Hugh Johnson says the economy is having a difficult time right now.
Obviously, the month of August was a real sinking spell, a loss of confidence by businesses and businesses simply holding the line on any further job additions to their payrolls.
President Obama is planning to introduce a plan for creating jobs when he delivers a speech to a joint session of Congress next week. The Gulf Coast is bracing for a big rainmaker. A tropical depression is moving slowly toward the region and is expected to move onshore tomorrow. Tropical storm warnings are up from Mississippi to Texas, including New Orleans. Mayor Mitch Landrieu fears the storm will cause flooding in his city.
If we get the amount of rainfall in the short period of time that they are in fact predicting, we can predict with some, you know, confidence that there may be water that accumulates on the streets of New Orleans. That happens all the time.
The threat of flash floods has prompted Louisiana's governor to declare an emergency. Forecasters say the storm could dump as much as 20 inches of rain in spots over southern Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. More rain has led to more flooding in Vermont. Last evening, two contractors were repairing a damaged bridge when they became trapped on a sandbar. They had to be rescued by helicopter. Flooding from Hurricane Irene cut off entire towns. Melody Baudet of Vermont Public Radio says people are pulling together, but it's still tough in parts of the state.
What's missing is roads and power, and in some cases, phone service. Power is starting to come back on slowly. There are towns where whole systems got wiped out, and it's going to take a little bit longer. But the roads are definitely in bad shape, and while people can get into these towns, it's still travel is not normal in Vermont right now.
A major earthquake in the North Pacific meant a rude awakening, but no damage for some Alaska residents. Alexander Gutierrez of member station KUCB in Unalaska reports the 7.1 magnitude quake hit a mostly unpopulated region of the state in the early morning hours.
For the second time this summer, residents of the Aleutian Islands evacuated for a tsunami warning. The fishing town of Unalaska lies about 200 miles away from the epicenter. Jarrell Burkholder and his fiancée were among the residents who were woken from their beds.
The cop cars were flying by, and then the big loudspeaker was, "This is not a drill. Get out of here." And we went to higher ground, and I knew the drill. Woke her up, and we got out of Dodge.
According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, no destructive wave was recorded, and coastal states are no longer in danger. For NPR News, I'm Alexander Gutierrez in Unalaska.
Checking Wall Street right now, the Dow is down 191 points at 11,302. The S&P down 22. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Living Essentials, distributor of 5-Hour Energy, with flavors including grape, berry, and orange, in stores and at 5hourenergy.com.
It's 11:04 on Radio Times on WHYY. Good morning. I'm Joanne Allen. Court documents say a high-ranking member of the Philadelphia Archdiocese lied to a man who complained he had been raped by a priest as a boy. The Inquirer reports Monsignor William Lynn told a grand jury that he lied because he believed the priest's admission of rape was a confidential matter between the priest and his doctor. A Pennsylvania lawmaker says the Harrisburg City Council's rejection of a fiscal recovery plan will mean the city can't make its upcoming bond payments. WHYY's Mary Wilson reports that may have consequences for Philadelphia.
Senator Jeffrey Pecola of Dauphin County says when council members voted 4-3 against the mayor's plan to bring the city out of debt with the help of state advisors, they put the bond rating of the Commonwealth and its municipalities in jeopardy.
So citizens in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Hazleton or over here in Cumberland County that have municipal and county governments that are fiscally sound and doing the prudent thing financially are going to find themselves paying higher interest rates.
Pecola has proposed legislation that would put Harrisburg on the road to financial rehabilitation, but the legislature can't take the measure up since it doesn't return to session until late September. Until then, Pecola says he's not arguing that the state advance Harrisburg any money. Governor Corbett says he's waiting for city council to make a move. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
Pennsylvania's independent fiscal watchdog has notified four school districts that he will be auditing the recent buyouts of their superintendents. Auditor General Jack Wagner informed the Philadelphia, Allentown, Central Dauphin, and Gettysburg school districts that he is going to take a look at those deals. Customers in Delaware could see lower heating bills this winter as a result of the low market price of natural gas. Delmarva Power plans to ask state regulators to approve a rate reduction that would trim the average residential customer's bill by nearly 4%, or about $6 a month. The Phils are in Florida starting a weekend series tonight. Partly sunny, highs around 80, 75 at the Jersey Shore, 71 degrees, Center City, Philadelphia. This is WHYY 1106.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's tough to pick out the most charming term of endearment that Paul West made up to describe his wife, Diane Ackerman, while he was recovering from serious stroke. Here are a few. My little bucket of hair, spy elf of the morning alleluias, apostle of radiant postage stamps, little moon skipper of the tumbleweed factory. Wes, who's a writer, suffered a stroke in 2003 that left him completely at a loss for words. He was diagnosed with severe global aphasia. Ackerman created a therapy for her husband that played to his strengths, his extraordinary vocabulary, his passion for language, and their playful verbal relationship. At her urging, he created pet names for her. Diane Ackerman writes about all of this in her new book called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Diane Ackerman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm delighted to see you again.
And I'm enjoying your, not little bucket of hair, but your large bucket of hair.
Yes, it's more of a weather system than a hairdo. So you can see why when he strolled out of the bedroom and put his hand over his heart as if he were going to do the Pledge of Allegiance and said, "My little bucket of hair."
There
I was
were.
Just tickled. Yeah.
He got he was actually sick in the hospital, and you came back from a book tour to be with him. He had an infection.
He did. He had a bladder infection, and I happened just coincidentally to be on tour with a book about the brain. So I knew in chilling detail what had happened to him. I was the best person, I suppose, but certainly the worst person, too, to have a spouse who'd had a stroke.
He was in the hospital for a couple of weeks with this infection.
Yes.
And then literally he has a stroke.
He had a stroke. And he had had a transient stroke some years before, and I knew all the symptoms. I knew exactly what had happened. What I didn't know is if he would also recover quickly mm-hmm. from this, or if this affliction would be with him.
And what did that stroke look like to you when you saw it?
His eyes were glazed. His mouth had fallen like mud. And he looked at me with eyes that were not expressive, but they were full of alarm. So he wasn't squinting them or anything, but I could just read the alarm in his eyes. And I said to him, "Are you having a stroke?" And he just looked at me.
He couldn't say anything.
He couldn't say a word. He he had the worst possible kind of stroke. Sometimes people get one kind where they can't speak well, but they understand what people are saying. And in the cruelest of ironies for the author of nearly 50 books and for his word-obsessed wife, he had a stroke that mainly hit the language areas of his brain. And he could no longer understand anything anyone said to him. But he also couldn't read, write, read clocks, do math.
Or speak.
Or speak. Most importantly, or speak or swallow. Or swallow food.
Well, I would love to have you read a section from the beginning of your book. And this is where you see that he has a stroke. He's in the hospital, and there you two are.
"Don't leave me," I silently pleaded. Instead, time and space did, rotating around both of us, and I felt tippy as if I were on shipboard in a bow-cracking storm. The bed's stainless steel began frying sparks. The walls curved into a bowl, and the nurse's voice scratched like an old-fashioned Victrola needle. As for Paul, he later told me that he'd felt assaulted by things bright and metallic, a twitch in every fiber of his being, bouncing pulses, weird ringing in his ears. There were odder phenomena, too, from a shaking sound in his head to a noise like crumbled tea leaves from somewhere in his lumbar region. Also, a belfry of quiet tinkling that roamed around his head. As his world tried to right itself between earth and heaven, he felt the presence of a wispy halo, making him wonder if he'd become one of the elect. Whenever the belfry sounds decreased for a slim moment, it drove him mad with delight. The dark night of the merry-go-round flashed through his mind. In his mouth, a taste balsamic and crude, which he fixed upon with all the rapture of a man touching a toothache in the night. His fingers, partially deprived of sensation, felt wax-like, dull, opaque, brutalized, and wouldn't respond. His whole body defied touch, as his flesh converted to something stiffer. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation, just different. He felt somewhere, without thinking the words, "What's happening? I'm still alive, sort of." A British policeman's stern baritone demanded, "What's all this here?"
And again, Diane Ackerman reading from her new book called 100 Names for Love. And your husband is able to recover some of this language. He also begins to write. So we not only see and learn about your experiences of his stroke, but his experience of having a stroke, which seems to me an extraordinary thing to learn.
Very, very rare, because by definition, somebody who has global aphasia can't tell you. And so I was able to find out a lot of what goes on in the mind of somebody who's having a stroke. And I discovered, for example, that they continue to have that dialogue that we have with ourselves. Mm-hmm. He heard speaking. It's just that because his brain was all miswired, he couldn't give the signal to his mouth to express it. And in time, when he began to get back just a couple of words, words would tumble out that he didn't want to. And that's often what happens, that somebody who's had a stroke can only say what the mouth can utter, not what they mean. And it can sound very confusing, but, you know, it can also sound very funny, and you can really enjoy it.
Well, you just, in that description is all the sort of noise, the clanking in his head.
Yes, he said that he actually felt his teeth blink.
Now, what do you think he meant by
that? I have no idea. I think his mouth felt very strange, the sensations, the nerves, yes.
He also writes, and this is when he begins to write, "On rare occasions, the word I sought lay like an angel begging to be used." And the idea that, you know, the word is over there, right?
Yes.
You just can't get to it.
Yes, it was horribly frustrating for him. And my challenge, among other things, among trying to keep together what had been a very long, sentimental, romantic, kissy love affair, was also to help him get back as much language as possible. And I discovered very quickly that all of the normal speech therapy that was taking place with him, because we went through five different therapists, really was just not right for someone like Paul, who was way too imaginative, But I think it was perhaps too rigid, too textbook, to work best maybe for anyone. It really was designed only for people with acute problems. And as I know from being a teacher, there are two ways to teach anything. You can teach from the lesson book, or you can figure out how the student needs to learn. And that takes a lot more work. But to individualize it like that is so much more effective.
And I'm wondering, with a more traditional therapy would, and I'm holding up a pen in front of you, so someone would say to your husband, this is a pen, and try to get him to say the word pen?
Yes, exactly. But I was walking through our little home library one day when a therapist was showing him a photograph of a telephone on a table. And she pointed to the table and she said, what's this? And he said, Skylargle. And she said, no, that's nonsense. It's a table. What's this? And she pointed to the telephone and he said, Tesseract. And she said, no, that's nonsense. But at that moment, really the trajectory of our lives changed because something dawned on me. And I turned around and went back in and said, you know, actually, a tesseract is a real word. It's a three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension. And in a funny way, that's what a telephone does. And I began to realize that, okay, the words that we learn as children are processed in the language areas of the brain.
Here's a pen, right?
Exactly. You know, that's mother. There's the sky. But it was possible that words that we learn as adults, maybe in hobbies or specialties, get processed elsewhere like a foreign language. And at that point, I just took over his therapy and started to work with him through that new vocabulary.
And you write about the fact, and you're both writers, so one can imagine, you know, this sort of land of language that you inhabited together. I mean, I think couples that love each other and spend time together create a language
they
for
do.
Each other.
I think love is essentially a cult of two with fallible gods and has its
a folie à deux, don't you think?
Yes, and has its own special rituals and lingo and everything. So there are other ways, and always the hobbies, the interests. There are different ways to do this.
And he had, before his stroke, had all sorts of pet names for you, I guess.
Yes.
Endearing, loving names for you.
Well, he used to make up little operettas about me in the course of the day. He would just improvise because we always were very playful. And if you're word people, of course, you play with words. And yes, and he lamented that he couldn't remember even one. He seemed so sad. And I was sad that he seemed to have lost his ability to describe things in images. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't you make up some new ones? And so casting about, he let the aphasia tumble out a little bit, just enough, and he had the thrill of being able to control it a little bit and whip out one a day for 100 days in a row.
Well, and, it's hard for me to pick my favorite here, but I love Apostle of Radiant postage stamps. I mean, that's just,
well, I like that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, what else do you like? And I should say to our listeners that these names are in the very back of Diane Ackerman's new book. Are there some ones that you just resonate with in particular?
Yes, I like Fleet-Footed Empress of Sleep, Rheostat of Sentimental Dreaming, My Little Celestial Porcupine. Now, this one is strange. My Billiard Table of the Decaying Gods. Where did that come from?
I circled that one because that seems so strangely delightful.
But how about Dark-Eyed Junko, My Little Bunko?
Yeah.
Or O Singing Squirrel of the Antipodes? and then maybe my favorite, because it just sounds like Whitman, I think,
yeah.
O Parakeet of the Lissom Star.
Wow. And right before that, Little Flavonoid Wonder.
Oh, I love that one, too. and Bobby Dazzler of the Golden Morn. He means the British bobbies, the policemen.
But you think, and this was every day, so he was, you gave him permission to just let the words come out.
Exactly.
Don't worry what they mean. Don't worry if they make sense together.
Yes, and this was really one of the strategies that I used, too, was circumlocution. In order to communicate, use anything that you can. And even if you need to do it in a roundabout way, let your brain hunt and do it, because what comes out can be very funny, and it's nice if you make people laugh.